now, your daily dose of debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. The last time President Trump was inaugurated, it produced not the biggest demonstration in American history, but certainly one of the biggest. You remember all that, and people started talking about impeachment way back then, and he hadn't even done anything yet. I mean, he was just taking the oath of office. And, okay, that was the Women's March, the resistance movement. There is now a disillusioned activist who was very much part of that movement, a strong supporter of Hillary Clinton. She is not going to be marching anymore. We'll try to understand why not. And it has to do with some of this nexus of sexual versus substantive politics. And the whole idea is there such a thing as a woman's point of view. We will get to that this hour on the Michael Medved Show. The President of the United States, who is the man of the hour, of course, everything is centered around him. Today he wins a gigantic victory with his United States-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, which was negotiated a long time ago. Then it was held up for political reasons by Nancy Pelosi and her allies in the House. And meanwhile, it just passed the Senate this morning by a squeaker vote. It was 89 to 10 with a number of people on the extreme left, including Chuck Schumer, by the way, who said he voted no on this new trade agreement, which would actually help our country because it didn't include enough environmental protections. That's why Bernie Sanders voted against it. That trade agreement now ready to be signed by President Trump, and it is a very big day on Wall Street. The market up to new record highs, over 200 points, the Dow, which is pretty amazing and worth celebrating. But the president, very conscious of the impeachment distraction, couldn't be in an entirely celebratory mood. He took a few moments to speak to the press. Listen.
We are booming. Our country is the hottest country anywhere in the world. There's nothing even close. Every world leader sees me. They say, what have you done? This is the most incredible thing that we've ever seen. I understand the stock market today broke 29,000. When I came in, it was a fraction of that. It was a number that frankly would have gone and it would have been cut in half had the other person or the other party won. The number would have been cut in half. We are doing so well, and I want to get more. We have tremendous room for growth in our country in terms of the economy. We have tremendous, powerful room for growth. So I'm going to be going to Davos. I'll be meeting the biggest business leaders in the world, getting them to come here. I'll also be meeting with foreign leaders. Okay.
And all to the good. And this is President Trump playing to his strength. And this is the basis in which he has every chance, every possibility of winning a resounding reelection victory. But then there's the matter of impeachment. Listen.
What's your view on how long it should take?
Well, I think it should go very quickly. It's a hoax. It's a hoax. Everybody knows that. It's a complete hoax. The whole thing with Ukraine. So you have a perfect phone call. This is a call, fortunately, it was actually two phone calls. You people don't report that. There were two calls. They were both perfect calls. In fact, probably among the nicest calls I've ever made to foreign leaders. Now, so you have these perfect calls, and everybody says it now. Before they knew they were so good, because fortunately they were transcribed, you had other people saying terrible things about the calls. You had a fake whistleblower that wrote a report that bore no relationship to what was said. Everything was false. You have now the Ukrainian president and the foreign minister of Ukraine saying there was nothing done wrong. In fact, they said there was absolutely no pressure whatsoever. Everything was perfect, and they impeach. It's totally partisan. We had 195 to nothing Republican votes. I guess we got a Democrat actually came over to the Republican side. We had 195 to nothing. This is a hoax. It's a shame. I did the biggest deal ever done in the history of our country yesterday in terms of trade and probably other things, too, if you think about it, the deal with China. And that was the second story to a total hoax. Today, we just had passed the USMCA. It's going to take the place of NAFTA, which was a terrible deal. And the USMCA will probably be second to this witch hunt hoax, which hopefully everyone knows is not going anywhere. There was nothing done wrong.
How many times did he say the word hoax? I think 8 in that little soundbite. And by the way, the president's most persuasive point here is that the foreign minister and the president of Ukraine have both agreed with him that they did not feel any pressure. And after all, they did not initiate any sort of negotiation. And the entire messed up Keystone Cops, Marx Brothers kind of antics that were centered around Rudy Giuliani are embarrassing, but it's hard to see that they are so consequential that you remove a president in the middle of his first term and in the middle of an election where if people disapprove of the president, they should go forward. I don't think President Trump, he'll do what he'll do. And he's obviously very emotional on this topic. And I think anybody with any kind of human feeling can understand that. But it doesn't really help to repeatedly say it was a perfect phone call. No phone call is perfect. No phone call is perfect. And it was perfect. It was one of the nicest phone calls I've ever had with foreign leaders. Of course, what that says to inquiring investigative reporters is, wait a minute, if that was the best phone call he ever had with a foreign leader, let's go check out some of the other calls, because what could have happened there? And remember, there were breaches in security where people released information about a previous call he had with the then president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, and then one that he had with the previous prime minister of Australia that got very contentious. Now, that was Malcolm Turnbull. He's gone. Peña Nieto is gone. Well, he was term limited down in Mexico. So is this what happens? You have a controversial phone call with the president of the United States and then you lose your position? Look, whether it was a perfect phone call or not, and I don't think they've pulled that alternative. In other words, if you took the American people at large and you said, read the transcript. And I, by the way, agree with the president and his supporters. I think everybody should read the transcript, because what you'll do is after you read the transcript, the number of people who would honestly say this was a perfect phone call, this was one of the most perfect phone calls ever, there's never been such a perfect phone call, the number of people who agree with that is going to be small. It's going to be low. It's going to be a 10% Kool-Aid drinkers. The number of people who believe on the other side, who believe, wait a minute, this phone call, my God, what he has done to the office of the presidency, we've never had anything like this. He asked the president of Ukraine for a favor, and the favor was improper. The number of people who believe that it was one of the worst phone calls ever in the history of the Republic, that number is also going to be small. And the number of people in the middle is going to be overwhelming, it seems to me, as long as people look at this in a fair-minded way and acknowledging that, wait a minute, this is a very imperfect phone call. There are elements of it that are kind of sleazy. I mean, it is strange to be asking for the investigation of a political rival by a foreign head of state. It's not a good thing. But it is not a high crime, misdemeanor, treason, or bribery. It is not impeachable, and it is not worth basically stopping everything else in the United States. What's shocking to me is how quickly the Iran danger has gone away. Do you remember last week, the media narrative was, we're at the edge of war. It could be the end of the world. This could be a war that would dwarf anything that happened in Afghanistan or in Iraq. And war with Iran could disrupt the world economy. It could cost. Okay, that danger seems to have receded. And it seems as if the United States actually, through a combination of leadership and some remarkably good luck, has actually advanced our interests. We're going to be talking about Iran a little bit later with Irlan Berman, who is an expert on the subject, who was saying that Tehran could turn Trump into a regime changer. But that's not the president's primary interest. His primary interest, and he's right about this, since he became president, is the welfare of the American people, not only our national security, but our prosperity and the welfare of the U.S. economy. And in his remarks to the press at this very, very dramatic moment, the president concluded with this.
We have the greatest economy in the history of our country. We have the highest job numbers today. It was just announced. We have more people working in the United States than ever before in the history of our country, almost 160 million people. We're doing an incredible job. And for absolutely no reason, and for absolutely no reason, I got impeached. It's a disgrace and it's a hoax. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
The press, of course, wanted further conversation with the president. And why wouldn't they? I actually love the idea that the president should go ahead and give testimony to the Senate, at least take advantage of his right to give the closing statement, which will make his foreordained, and it is foreordained, his foreordained victory in the final Senate vote all the more sweet to the president of the United States if he is directly, personally, prominently involved. I suspect he might do it. The 538 is offering polling on impeachment. And they ask this. Do Americans support removing President Trump from office? Whoa, 8% of Republicans support it. That means that 92% either oppose it or are undecided or don't know or don't care. Among Democrats, 84% support removing Trump from office. That's tough, and boy, does that creates a situation for some of the endangered Democratic senators like Doug Jones of Alabama. What does he do on something like that? I mean, he's going to be facing a really tough race, especially since it appears that Alabama Republicans are going to have the good sense this time not to nominate Judge Roy Moore, which, by the way, I hope he pursues another line of work other than running for office. But Ted Cruz, who runs for office much more successfully, was the main runner-up in the presidential race with President Trump, just got himself reelected senator from Texas, beat Beto O'Rourke, you may remember, by about 2 percentage points, which is tens of thousands of votes in Texas. He was on the Senate trolley and spoke about impeachment. Listen.
I'm headed to the Senate floor, getting ready for the start of the impeachment trial. The partisan circus that we've seen in the House is over. We're getting ready to receive the House managers. Shortly after that, all 100 senators will be sworn in by the Chief Justice. We will then proceed to have a fair trial, to respect due process. Unlike the House, to give the president a full and fair opportunity to defend himself, and then we'll decide this issue based on the constitutional standards for impeachment, which is high crimes and misdemeanors. The House articles don't meet that standard. They don't allege any criminal conduct whatsoever. So at the end of this process, after a fair trial, the president will be acquitted, and we will end this constitutional circus, this political farce that started in the House. This is the beginning of the end of the abuse of the Constitution.
And that's Senator Ted Cruz, the junior senator from the great state of Texas. And by the way, I think talking about a political circus and a constitutional farce, that's probably better than hoax or sham. But again, it's the entire process has been an unnecessary infliction of damage on the body politic. Yet there is a great desire on the part of mainstream media to invest the entire situation with gravity and dignity and solemnity and moment. And somber was the word of the day yesterday. Somber, describing the impeachment managers. Here is a little media collage prepared by the Tom Elliott of Grabian about people talking about the formal procedure of actually delivering the articles of impeachment. Listen.
The history of this moment. As a student of American history, people are going to be studying this for a long time.
Just the ceremony of it, walking over, delivering the articles of impeachment.
The House clerk right now appears to still be holding on to the articles of impeachment from what we can tell from the cameras right there.
Through the rotunda, through Statuary Hall, back to the House of Representatives.
And just thinking about the history that they're walking through.
This is history, Nia. This is history unfolding.
There's a sacramental quality to this. There's a ritual.
I'm so glad Chris used the word ritual, because that's the word that has been stuck in my head about this all day today. There is something almost religious to it.
And I think Pelosi's a real believer in this, about ritual.
She said he's been impeached forever. They can never erase that. And
well, there's
we know
a,
that's
there's
something...
a sacramental statement.
Yes.
For life, like a priest for life. It is a perfect statement of what she is. I think she's very reverential.
A lot of members felt, and they told me as they were waiting, that this was an historic moment they didn't want to miss.
One of the things these senators are going to have to think about is, what do they want us to think about when we look at their portrait?
Portrait, or, and some of them might think there will be actual statues that we will someday walk by.
There will be actual statues of Nancy Pelosi, of Adam Schiff, of Jerry Nadler, in Statuary Hall? I don't know. Look, the idea, are we now, with all this talk of sacrament and ritual, do we have a brand new Church of the Holy Impeachment? Is that, I mean, and I don't know, what's the Holy Trinity for the Church of the Holy Impeachment? I think I just named it. Trinity there would be Pelosi, Schumer, and Schiff. Does Pelosi get to be the a Holy Spirit in that one? I mean, honestly, I look, it's a serious moment, but I think it is frankly rendered less serious by the fact that there is so little chance of success. And one of the reasons that I just instinctively recoil at this whole thing, and people who listen to this show know this, I do not like gestural politics. The idea that, okay, we're going to express ourselves and express our opinions, and it doesn't matter that this has no impact, that there is no chance, that there's no possibility. We need to do this because we need to show how we feel. Politics shouldn't be about feeling. It should be about doing. It shouldn't be about what you feel or how you feel or the solemnity of the moment. It should be the productivity of the moment. How are you using political power at this moment to improve the lives of the citizens? Now, the ultimate in the politics of feeling that I think is so destructive to this country and actually is driving us apart, the ultimate in that politics of feeling are all those thousands of people who put on their cute little pink little kitten hats to protest the president from day one. That, of course, was the Women's March, the resistance. Well, could it be the end of the resistance? It is, for one writer in The Federalist, Libby Emmons. Here's why I'm not going back to the Women's March. Why not? We will get to that coming right up on The Medved Show. On the Michael Medved Show, it's supposed to be just a given that women are on the left. And when, as appears increasingly likely, President Trump wins reelection, that women of America will once again rise en masse to protest and to decry and to express their pain and their suffering. Well, there's one protester from last time, some 3 years ago, who marched together with the Women's March back in 2017, who says, "I ain't marching anymore." Her name is Libby Emmons. She has written a very provocative piece for The Federalist, where she is a senior contributor. She's a writer and a mom living in Brooklyn, New York. Libby, congratulations on the piece. And first of all, to give people a sense of what you're writing about, why did you decide to go to the first Women's March back in 2017?
Well, I was opposed to Trump's election as president. I had voted for Hillary Clinton, and I had been sort of sure that she would win up until the last maybe month or so of the election. So along with many of my friends who were also disappointed, we decided to make our voices known, and we thought the Women's March was a great place to do it.
And and you describe the experience there, and you describe the experience in sort of a homey manner. What surprised you about the Women's March when you went to it?
What mostly surprised me was how little it had to do with women's issues and women's rights. I was raised my mom was not really around, but I did see her on school breaks and things. And I also had a stepmother who was very present. And seeing both of these women make different choices about how to deal with motherhood and raising children and things like that had given me a pretty clear perspective on the validity of women's choices, and that there aren't really there aren't exactly clear-cut right answers for everyone. And what I saw at the Women's March was something much more like determinations that these questions had already been answered, that there's only one correct way to be a woman in today's America. It's not about raising children. That's, of course, off the table. No one thinks that's important anymore on the progressive side. As a matter of fact, one of the pieces I wrote that came out today for The Federalist was about how the Democratic candidates at the debate on Tuesday night were so sure that the best thing for moms and children is to have daycare, starting with free universal infant care. And the idea, as a mom myself, that my child in infancy would be better off in someone else's hands so that I can return to the workforce is pretty well horrifying. You know, there's nothing better than taking care of your own kid if you're able to do it. And what I found before my son was born, I worked full time. I was out of the house pretty much all the time. You know, I often referred to my home as the cat's house because, you know, I was never there. My husband was never there. And then after my son was born, the concept of going back to work full time was completely anathema to my desires. And I figured out how to make it work. My life is completely different now, and I'm happy about that. These were not options that were valued or on display at the Women's March. And instead, the idea was that there was a collection of values, a platform of values and perspectives that you needed to get on board with 100%.
And then part of that includes cheering for abortion, not just cheering for choice, but actually cheering for lauding abortion. That bothered you.
Yeah, that definitely bothered me. I think it was a few years ago that Lindy West came out with a book called Pro. I think it was her. Sorry if I get that wrong. But the idea, and she also launched this hashtag on social media that was Shout Your Abortion. And I think we also saw that at the Golden Globes last week. One of the actresses.
Yeah, Michelle Williams.
Williams was talking about how great her abortion was. And I think that this is terrible. You know, I think this is just terrible. I was, I went to Catholic school as a kid and I was raised Catholic, and we were pretty clear on the idea that abortion was a terrible thing. But again, my mom was a feminist, and talking to her about it, she had talked to me about the idea that it should be safe, legal, and rare, which used to be the mantra of Planned Parenthood and the mantra of feminists who were in favor of choice, which is a completely different thing than being in favor of abortion. Right. And I think that that really jumped the shark. For me personally, that changed my view from being, you know, pro-choice and saying, like, yes, I am pro-choice, to being like, maybe I'm not pro-choice after all. I do think that women need to have control over their own bodies and their own reproductive life, but I don't think that, I mean, abortion is just not the way to do it. It's a horror show. And having it be something that is just like, I need to do this for my career, is completely outside the realm of what should be considered okay.
That's Libby Emin. She is the author of this new piece, a recent piece in The Federalist. It's called Here's Why I'm Not Going Back to the Women's March. Let me ask you this, because your piece emphasizes your changed point of view toward the politics of the leaders of the Women's March and the whole nature of that movement. But have you also changed your opinion of President Trump?
Not really, no. I'm not a huge fan. Uh-huh. But I don't think that he's the Antichrist like so many of my peers do.
Let me ask you this. Are there any of the Democratic candidates who seem exciting to you, who seem to get it, who speak to people like you, who really sounds like you're in the political center? Any of the Democrats who speak to you?
Is impossible now. No, and that has been a source of dismay for me.
To the whole country, it's a source of dismay.
I haven't seen anybody that I could possibly... I wasn't in favor of Bernie the first time around. I'm not in favor of... Elizabeth Warren at all. I'd like to see someone out there who actually cares about what people want to do with their own lives instead of constantly prescribing the right answers. And I think that's too bad. I think that has a lot to do with why Trump was able to win the last election, because people are tired of being told what to do and told that they're voting against their own interests. People know what they want. Americans aren't stupid.
Yeah,
they know what's going on.
I do think the hysterical edge to particularly the extreme left right now, and the idea that they're having this big major World War III over on the Democratic side about whether it's possible that Bernie said in December of 2018. That if mm-hmm. Bernie said that, well, maybe a woman is going to have a tough time winning election, that this is the kind of thought crime that should disqualify you from the presidency. I think Bernie ought to be disqualified because he's a socialist, he's an isolationist, he's mm-hmm. an extremist, and he's a cranky old man. But this is the one thing that now you've gone too far, Bernie. Now you've crossed a red line. I don't get that.
Well, what's funny, too, is you can... certainly imagine him saying this, that, you know, you can certainly imagine him saying that a woman can't win the presidency. And what he's probably doing is not stating his own perspective on whether or not that's all right. He's talking about, you know, the game. He's talking about the political system, which is what everybody does. People are so infrequently speaking their own mind, and they're just talking about what the playing field looks like. And obviously that's what he was doing.
Libby Emin's Keep Them Coming. Your piece is excellent. It's posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. It's about her disillusionment with the Women's March. And she's still looking for some kind of source of political inspiration. So why is it that we can't find that source of political inspiration in the Democratic side at all? Michael Moore has a perspective on that coming up. On the Michael Medved Show, I don't know, we were talking about the Democratic debate as the rumble in the jungle. I don't know if there's much jungle around Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa, but there has to be a better name for it, because the debate really was boring and uninteresting. What has become more interesting and seems to have riveted the American people is the conflict between two old friends, dear friends, close friends, ideological colleagues. That would be Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, both United States senators, both from New England, both sworn in today in the ceremony on the Senate floor with Chief Justice John Roberts. They're both done with campaigning for a while, which is probably a good thing. What's astonishing is the level of vitriol that has been building up among their supporters and among the candidates themselves. The story was that if you stay tuned to the debate afterward to listen to some of the analysis, then you saw the famous video of Bernie apparently coming up to Elizabeth Warren to shake her hand. It's a courtesy. And she won't shake his hand. And then what happened is after that developed, somebody found the sound. There's, of course, an open mic up there. And this is not a joke. This is the real sound. And the sound you'll hear is Elizabeth Warren and then Bernie Sanders. And the third voice you'll hear is Tom Steyer, who says, wait, let me out of here. I don't need to participate in this particular brawl. Here's what the interchange between the two progressive champions sounded like.
I think you called me a liar on national TV.
What?
I think you called me a liar on national TV.
Let's not do it right now. You want to have that discussion? We'll have that discussion. You called me. You told me. All right, let's not do it now.
I don't want to get in the middle, but I just want to say hi, Bernie.
Yeah, good. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, that's Tom Sayre. I don't want to get in the middle. She said it twice. I think you called me a liar on national TV, and that was question mark. Bernie didn't deny it. That was what was so extraordinary. And what's also extraordinary is there are now reports that Bernie Sanders has been raising a ton of money based upon this particular controversy. He already has a ton of money. You know, he's raised more than $100 million, which for a socialist guy who wants the government to control everything, it's pretty good. I do think that people really should start thinking about the possibility of a Trump-Sanders race and what that would look like and how terrible that would be for the country. I mean, really, can you imagine? If there is anything even less appetizing than the incredibly the incredibly depressing prospect of a Clinton Trump race, I was just thinking about. I have over my desk. I have a bumper sticker that which says "Bigfoot for President," and the subline is. I don't believe in Hillary or Trump either. Okay, you remember that. There are a lot of people who felt like, do you know how many people would be left extraordinarily disillusioned if the choice is Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump? President Trump will get his supporters, loyal supporters, and that's at least 40% of Americans. It's probably closer to 50% now. Certainly on impeachment it is. But Michael Moore has picked up just how depressing this Sanders-Warren sexism feud is. This is what the political commentator and Oscar-winning filmmaker had to say. Listen.
What did you think about this feud between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders this week?
It was very sad. I still, as we tape this, do not understand why Elizabeth's people did that, and then why she just couldn't, you know, you couldn't even read in her statement what really was said or what happened in it. And again, I know her, and I've had her in my films, and I've always loved her, and so I'm just, the focus has to be about Trump. It has to be about the system that gave us Trump to make sure that doesn't happen again. And the fact that we would be talking about this, and I've known Bernie since the 80s, so there's no way he said anything like the way it's been reported. So, I mean, to be honest, the night that happened, my first thought was, they will mark this day, January 13th, as the day Donald Trump was reelected. Because once again, the Democrats, the liberals, the left, couldn't get it together, couldn't figure out, instead of much so happy to get right in there and fight each other like this. And I'm like, when are we ever going to learn? This is on us. This is not on the Russians. It's not on the Republicans. It's on the Democratic Party for not getting its act together, not using its head.
Well, it's because in the Democratic Party, and in some precincts of the Republican Party, but thank God it's not the whole party, you have thought crimes. You have the idea that if you say something, oh, that's a and again, it's a matter of opinion. I don't believe that Bernie really said something as stupid as a woman can't be elected president. But let's imagine that he did. Why is it worthwhile for Elizabeth Warren's staff, later backed up by the candidate herself, to bring that out? Was that so shocking? Was that so off, out, not worthy of consideration? Because I think the allegation, at least the way it's come down now with what Senator Warren is saying, is not that Bernie said, I don't believe that a woman can serve as president. What he was saying is, I don't think a woman can beat Donald Trump. And the idea that he might have said something like that, or even vaguely like that, and that rather than going to Bernie Sanders, who you've known for many years, and saying, Bernie, you said something that really bothered me. I wanted to get clear on it. He would have clarified it immediately. And this clearly is something, if Elizabeth Warren didn't want it, at least her backers did, because they released it. And it may be because she sees that very clearly Bernie Sanders is pulling away from her, is winning much stronger support. And I actually don't believe that this controversy is going to end that tendency in any way. It probably will expedite it. Because one thing that people like about Bernie is he's Bernie. He's authentic. That's the word that people use. It's really that guy, which I actually find deeply scary, because it is unfortunately true believers in politics, and particularly in dictatorship, who have done most of the truly devastating damage in American life. The people who caused the Civil War, who led to secession and bloodshed, were true believers. I think that well, you can say a lot of things about Adolf Hitler. He was authentically that guy. And again, I'm not comparing Bernie Sanders to Hitler. And I'm not comparing him to the people who launched the Civil War, the so-called Southern Fire Eaters. But I am saying that this idea that it's always honorable to be constantly at war with your political enemies. What I find interesting is that when Pete Buttigieg won an essay contest when he was a high schooler, he won an essay contest because of his admiration of Bernie Sanders. One of the things he admired about Bernie Sanders was the actual ability to work with people who were, gasp, Republicans. Whatever happened to that aspiration? I think it's, frankly, part of the American political tradition, and worth affirming in this greatest nation on God's green earth.